for his service and editor of papers at the Inquirer, and that we're reading her articles and reviews, sharing scholarly journals, interviews, and many other publications. He is the author of a book on William Jackson, a leader of church and state in 17th century England. We're going to be excited to get into the center. Thomas President and Adjunct Lecturer in the History Department at IUPUI. In addition to his membership in numerous professional societies and organizations, he has been involved in the presentation of historical conferences, including the Luke Wallen Symposium at Wabash College in 2005. From 2002 to 2006, Tom served as Vice President of the Indiana Historical Society Press, and he was president of the Indiana Association of Historians in 2008 and 2009. He's also the project director for a forthcoming edition of the papers of Lou Wallace, Lou and Susan Wallace, and that will soon be published on 5DVD by the Indiana Historical Society on the local library that I use in the room. Tonight, we'll be speaking on the hall for the letters of Lou and Susan Wallace, and I'd like to welcome to the podium Tom Newman.
Thank you. Is the microphone working? Can anybody hear? When I came here now 26 years ago to the Indiana Historical Society, the Society had four major documentary editions in various stages of production. The first of those was a book ultimately published as The Journals of William Lindsay, an Ordinary 19th Century Physician Surgical Notes. Lindsay practiced medicine at a particularly recent time after the invention of anesthesia, but before the invention or discovery of anesthetics. So they adopted or they launched much more ambitious, gory surgeries, but could not prevent infection. That's a book interesting in that way. We got that out in 1989. Then the second big documentary edition was the correspondence of William McClure, who was known as the father of American geography. He was instrumental in setting up the community in Harmony. Actually, I think he was the first proprietor in Harmony, and that edition records his correspondence with Maurice Kirkendall, who was an educational reformer. Huge book, and we got that one out in 1994. Then the press also had a long-running project of the papers of William Henry Harrison during his years of territorial governor and later the general in 1812. That was produced by the head editor, Douglas Clarence, and that was a microfilm edition that we brought out in 1999. But the Society's biggest editing project, which surely also gets the prize for longevity, here's the papers of Lou and Susan Wallace. This is a comprehensive, collected edition, and it includes all the writings of the Civil War Major General and his wife. When we say it's comprehensive, what we mean is it includes all the correspondence to and from both Lou and Susan Wallace, all of their literary manuscripts, both of them were prolific authors. And Susan Wallace, well, actually both of them, wrote both fiction and nonfiction. This edition includes their essays, their speeches, newspaper articles, and all of Lou Wallace's military orders. When we say it was collected, we mean that it's drawn together. It includes reproductions of documents from 100 repositories, mostly from here in the United States, but a few from repository libraries archived in other countries, such as the British Library, the public record office of Northern Ireland, and perhaps most exotic of all, the Ottoman Archives in Istanbul. Because Lew Wallace was the U.S. minister of what today we call ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. Ultimately, this edition includes 9,500 documents and 168 images. The project began in 1984 when Donald Thompson, the global librarian at Wabash College, launched this project as a retirement project for himself and others. Donald Thompson previously had been the compiler editor of Indiana authors and their works. There's a three-volume biographical directory that was published by Wabash College. And he thought that the Wallace Baker Project would result in a book edition. That's the way people used to think 23 years ago. But he told me that he never dreamed that they would find so many documents. And at his death in 1992, the search for documents was still far from complete. We, at the Indiana Historical Society, tried to keep the project at Wabash, but the college declined to do so, and ultimately we brought the Wallace papers to the Indiana Historical Society in 1994. We tried to get advice from a number of worthwhile sources, and we sought the advice of the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. The NHPRC is an agency of the National Archives. We've already discovered far more documents than could cost-effectively be produced in a book format. And the NHPRC recommended that we produce a microfilm edition of photo facsimiles of the documents. And they recommended that we not try to include transcriptions since the project had already, at that stage, been gone for 8 years. And to try to include transcriptions would have extended the life of the project for many years in the future. Although here we are now, more than 20 years later. At that time, 20 years ago, electronic publishing was available. But it was notorious that electronic storage degraded. I think we've all lived through the 12-inch diskettes, the 8-inch diskettes, the thumb drive, and if you got any from the early period, you know that the data was probably no good anymore. In fact, a huge problem at the National Archives is they got the old reel-to-reel tapes in the pop cards with no hardware to go on, because the hardware doesn't exist. So suddenly the vast category of documents are gone. So that's a reason why the NHPRC recommended not an electronic edition at that time, but rather a microfilm edition, because even then, microfilm has been around for 80 years, and now it's been around for probably almost a century. And it's still good. You can still put the machine in use. But it's a measure of what's happened in the last 20 years that hardly anybody, other than reader versions or scholars, uses the microfilm reader anymore. And it's clear that if you wanted, both from the perspective of trying to disseminate, get your edition out there, and also if you want to have any hopeful book, that we call a costly public, non-profit publishing, but it's not a profit, but at least you hope that the cover the cost, you got to have some sales. And so if you're going to sell these things, it's now, it's got to be in electronic format. So the Indiana Historical Society decided once the project was finished, the Edmund work was done about 5 years ago, that instead of trying to market it and sell it, there's a microfilm edition. Ultimately, even in microfilm, 49 rolls of microfilm. Can I interest anybody in the audience in buying 49 rolls of microfilm, perhaps? Even at discount pricing. So we concluded correctly that, if you wanted this thing to sell and you wanted to be actually used, it's got to be in electronic format. So the society, after I left, they sent the microfilm to India, where it was digitized, and now the society has a grant application in the production cost of actually producing the DVD after those funds are sold and marketed. And we hope that it will reach a good size market. This project has already, even when we produced it in Microsoft, it's got what we call an electronic finding aid. And with this, basically it's an interactive database, and you can search the 9,500 documents for the name of correspondent, sender or recipient. You can search it by date, or you can search it by the name of the repository, the library, where the original is called. This database is in Microsoft Access. There's also a whole category that we call the itinerary. If you want to know where Lou was or Susan was, any day or year throughout their lives, this itinerary has 1,175 entries. And so basically, it'll tell you, if they were in transit, where they were going, where they were, what the evidence is that they were in Baltimore, Maryland on such a day. The Historical Society supported this project from the early days. When it was based at Wabash College, because the Society has in its library one of the largest collections of the Susan Wallace papers. Actually, we mostly discovered Grant on the Cosmos, the biggest collection of them all was in the National Archives. Nevertheless, right here at the Society, there is one of the largest, let's call it a plurality of size of the collection. And that, here in the library, the collection is called the Lou Wallace Collection, 20 manuscript boxes. It was processed by Paul Bronson. And the Society got this collection in 1940 when Lou's grandson, Lou Wallace Jr., sold the collection. And the Society bought it with support from the Lilly Endowment. Of course, behind the Lilly Endowment, the decision maker in this case, perhaps to no one's surprise, was J.K. Lilly Jr. He was a major manuscript collector, a bibliophile, and when the opportunity presented itself to acquire Lou Wallace's paper, J.K. Lilly Jr. Helped to make it happen. A few years ago, I was out at Eagle Creek Park. That's an interesting background. Eagle Creek Park used to be J.K. Lilly Jr.'s kind of country estate. If you go out there, there's a rustic-looking building that the park calls the Lilly Loft. From the outside, it looks like kind of rustic cabin, kind of quarter chimney. When you get up a little bit closer, you'll notice that the windows, however, are of steel frame. You get inside, and behind a Nazi pine panel, kind of rustic, open that, and behind that is a huge steel door. It's essentially a walk-in vault, and the steel door is like a bank vault. And on the outside, it's a steel press. Literary manuscripts and miscellaneous. So that's where J.K.'s collection was housed until he built the major research library at IU Bloomington in 1960 that was in writing. So prior to 1960, all of his collections were railroad manuscripts out there. And you walk into this thing, and today, Eagle Creek Park keeps its office supplies and eventually, in the paper in there. But when you look at it closely, the shells are not wood, they're metal. So the whole thing is designed to be fireproof, particularly close. From 1940 onwards, the whole collection is here. So that across the street in the old State Library building, the historical society is out there. And then when the Lilly Library was built in 1960, the several institutions, J.K. Little was still alive at that point, made the decision to artificially separate the line of the collection between what they defined as political military papers that stay here versus literary, what they defined as literary papers that went to the IU Bloomington campus at the Little Library. So if you want to see the manuscript of Ben-Hur, if you want to see any and all of the correspondence that Lee Wallace conducted with his publisher, Harper Row, and of course, that's all along the story from Bloomington. Also, though, an extraordinary level of cooperation continued between the two institutions. So that when we were developing this papers of literature law, you know, all the literary stuff was done alone. Well, but we had the preservation microfilm on it and the capability of filming the document. So the Lilly Library staff, notably Saunders Taylor, who was the curator of the manuscript, and Cheryl Baumgart, who was the cataloger of the manuscript, literally put all of their new walls and student walls material in boxes in their car and drove it up here. And it was here for 3 or 4 weeks while our preservation microfilm lab filmed the material. Now that, if you work in the library setting, is an extraordinary cooperation, and you don't ordinarily get that. And as a result, the agreement with the Lilly Library that they will be a co-publisher of the edition together with the Historical Society in recognition of their truly extraordinary cooperation. Because, first of all, the collections here in the library, and then because we've got this collective comprehensive edition coming out, these resources led to a number of important spin-off publications. And the earliest of those was the bibliography of, actually, with Wallace was part of a larger work of bibliography, of bibliographical studies of 7 authors in Crawfordsville, Indiana. This is one of several bibliographies funded by the editor, J.K. Lilly Jr., and the editor bibliographers were Dorothy Rucker Russo and Selma Lois Sullivan. They produced this one, the 7 authors of Crawfordsville. They also did the big bibliography on James Wilson Riley. They did the bibliography of Luke Harrison and some others. So that was the first, if you will, product spin-off based on this collection. Then in 1985, the Society's Preservation Imaging Department filmed Series 1. There's actually 13 series within the Lewis collection here in the library. And they created 16 microfilm bowls, which you can either use in the library or you buy. However, that's not a collector's edition. That's just libraries on hold. Then, in 2005, Ray Blumenhauer at the Indiana Historical Society Press wrote this book called The Sword and the Pen, A Life of Lynn Wallace, and it's part of a series of books that the press is publishing aimed explicitly at young readers, but certainly speaking for myself only, I can be there, and I thought all of that could. And the nice thing about this book is it draws upon the full range of photos available mostly here at the Historical Society that I had never seen before in any similar book. Then in 2010, Gail Stevens wrote this wonderful book, Shadow of Shiloh, Major General Lew Wallace and the Civil War. So the press came out with this in 2010, one of the illustrated on the map. If you want to know the blow-by-blow description of Wallace's movement to the Battle of Shiloh, which was the place that it was. And perhaps most recently, there was a conference of Wabash College in 2005, Lou Wallace, and 3 years later, the Indiana Magazine of History published the major papers that were presented there, including one that I and four of my colleagues at the Historical Society Press presented on the Wall Street Project. So these, both the physical records in the library and then the editing project from the press have led to, they've already, shall we say, borne fruit in publication even before the edition was published. Now, this is my first, I hope this works. Yes, it's wrong. This is Lou Wallace's father, David Wallace. Actually, the first member of the Wallace family to come here in Indiana was Lou Wallace's grandfather, Andrew Wallace. He moved from Pennsylvania to southern Indiana. And ultimately settled in Brickville, near Cincinnati. He served as a quartermaster in General William Henry Harrison's army during the War of 1812. And then Lou Wallace was born in 1827 in Brookville. He was the second four sons of David Wallace. David Wallace went to West Point, class of 1821, and his mother was Esther French Kett Wallace. Sad to say, she died when Lou was 7 years old. David remarried, ultimately, marrying Zerelda Sanders, and David Wallace was elected governor of Indiana in 1837 for one term. Young Lou made a habit of running away from home and running away from school from time to time. And in 1840, he went to Tippecanoe to a celebration commemorating William Henry Harrison's victory there in 1811. Of course, 1840 was the great year of the Log Cabin and Hard Cider campaign when William Henry Harrison became the president. So he all felt the opportunity not to be missed. As the 1840s progressed, there was a phenomenon, whether it was both north and south, in, on the county level and local level. He developed local militia companies. And in Montgomery County, later lived in Montgomery County, in 1845, Lou Wallace raised a company, his company of Indiana Volunteers, that elected him as a lieutenant. At that stage, he was 18 years old, and he then took his company to the Mexican War, as part of the First Indiana Infantry. He didn't see much action. He was stuck in a camp on the Brazos River, north of the Rio Grande River. He saw a minor skirmish, but missed the major battle of Buena Vista in northern Mexico in February of 1847. He then shipped back to New Orleans with the 1st Indiana Regiment in June of that year. The following year, he went to a commencement ceremony at Wabash College, where he met Susan Arnold Elson. She was the daughter of a wealthy banker, Major Isaac Elson, and ultimately, there's a young Lou Wallace in 1850, and there's Susan Elson, who ultimately married Lou Wallace in 1852. But before that happened, first of all, Wallace is admitted to the bar. In those days, lawyers did not always go to college, and there were really no or few, if any, organized law school. So the way you prepared for law would be you would read the law in the offices of Cambridge at an academy where. So that's what Lou Wallace did. And he began to practice law in Indianapolis in 1849. Then, while he was living here in Indianapolis, one of the things he discovered with his documentary edition that he edited a paper, a newspaper, of which only one issue survived, called the Free Soil Banner. And that will give you a clue, an insight into Wallace's political views at this time during the late 1840s, basically. The Free Soil Democrat, he becomes Stephen Douglas Democrat, a war Democrat, as the Civil War heats up, and once you get into the Civil War, he gravitates toward the Republican Party. He was elected prosecuting attorney, practiced in Covington, Indiana, and during in the legal district. Basically, in those days, the state the prosecuting attorney represented the congressional district of Indiana. In 1852, he married Susan in Crawfordsville. The following year, he moved to Crawfordsville and lived there, except for his army service and some of his appointed to officers that were taken away, whether it was in Mexico or to Turkey. But basically, Crawfordsville remained his home base for the rest of his life. There in Crawfordsville, he started working on his first novel. It was going to be a novel set in Mexico. Treating Cortez's conquest of Mexico and relations with Montezuma and the fair god. He showed the manuscript to the president of Wabash College, Charles White, who promptly advised Lew Wallace to give up writing. While we have Susan Wallace up on the screen, I'll point out that she became a published author of both of fiction and nonfiction. Really, all of her works started appearing later in life in the 1880s, starting with The Story of the Sea, Ginevra, that was published in 1887, Land of the Pueblos. All of her works were travel nonfiction, based on her experiences in the areas where she lived when she went with me to some of these more exotic locales, such as Santa Fe, New Mexico, or Istanbul. When she, after she was in Turkey, she wrote a book called The Repose in Egypt, and another one called Along the Bosphorus and Other Sketches. She encouraged other writers, especially the sisters Mary Hannah Prout and Caroline Virginia Prout, who lived in Crawfordsville. Then after Lew Wallace died, she worked to bring her husband's autobiography to publication. Mary Hannah Prout helped her with that. And the author of the article on Lew Wallace in Indiana Authors and Their Work noted that it has been suggested that the literary taste of Mrs. Wallace was somewhat superior to that of her husband, and that his work could have been improved in style and structure by even more of her editing than the piece. As happened in 10 years before the Mexican War, as the Civil War started heating up, Lew Wallace organized a militia company in Montgomery County called Montgomery Guards. He went to great lengths to obtain textbooks from West Point. His father's gone to West Point. And that became part of his problem during the Civil War, with a rivalry between the volunteer officers versus the West Pointers. Wallace then did everything he could, however, as a militia member, to train himself. He attended the state Democratic Convention as a delegate for Stephen Douglas, He was elected to the Indiana Senate as a Democrat and served two terms. He went to Illinois for the Lincoln Douglas debate, particularly in Charleston in September of 1858. And then when the Civil War broke out, he was actually arguing a case outside of Indiana. And he got a telegram from Governor Oliver Morton summoning him to Indianapolis. So he came back here to Indianapolis, and Governor Morton asked him to serve as Adjutant General. Then as now, of course, the Adjutant General today is in charge of the National Guard, and those days he's in charge of the militia. And it was his job, Paul's job, to handle the recruiting of the Indiana regiments for the Civil War. Reputedly, he had a deal with Morton. Of course, Lew Wallace wanted a field command. And so the deal was, I'll do Adjutant General work in recruiting for the first month if you'll give me the command of a regiment at the end of the month. So he served for 30 days, April 1861, after which point, fascinating the volume of telegraphic traffic that was coming in to the Adjutant General's office as he was raising regiments throughout the state in April 1861. At the end of that month, Morton was good on his agreement, and gave Wallace a commission in the 11th Indiana Volunteer Infantry. Wallace was always a kind of romantic, colorful character, and he gave his regiment DuMont uniforms. Let's see, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Here's Oliver Morton, the governor, war governor of Indiana. And here is a scene outside the State House where Wallace's regiment, the 11th Indiana, is about to go off to war, and he calls upon his regiment to get down on their knees and proclaim in a great shout that they were going to remember Buena Vista, and that is a reference to the incident that happened during the Mexican War that then Colonel Jefferson Davis was commanding a Mississippi regiment, and they were in cooperation in action with Indiana regiment. And Davis was heard to say disparaging things about the performance of the Indiana regiment. So Wallace was telling his men of the 11th Indiana that we're going to avenge these nasty remarks of Jeff Davis and remember Buena Vista. He then took his regiment to, and there's Wallace in a Zouave uniform. By the way, I need to thank Ray Blumhauer for supplying the photos that went into this PowerPoint. I'm grateful to him that he had these in his office and allowed me to do them. Wallace went with the 11th Indiana to what today is West Virginia. In those days, before the separation of West Virginia, Romney, in the western part of the state, was the scene of a small battle in which the 11th Indiana took part. He then reorganized the 11th Indiana after the termination of 3 months enlistment. By the way, everybody, I'm sure you know, everybody thought the war was going to be over. Everybody thought it was going to be short. Why did they want that Christmas take off? And his 11th Indiana then was sent to Paducah, Kentucky to reinforce Brigadier General Charles F. Smith in the West. And at that stage, Lew Wallace was promoted to Brigadier General. In early 1862, he commanded a newly formed 3rd Division at Fort Donelson, and was very successful, basically reinforcing General Grant. By the end of March of that year, he was a major general. And by the time, at that stage, he was the youngest major general in the Union Army. That's the good news.
not all good news. You can imagine how West Point felt about that. You can also imagine perhaps how his militia fellow officers felt about this kind of young upstart. And also, Wallace was not known for suffering fools gladly, and he had a kind of a short fuse, short temper. So there's not only his rapid promotion, but also the fact that he was coming up from the militia ranks. And as we'll see, he was known as a political general. Well, and that, as Alan Nolan used to say, that has the additional advantage of being the truth. That is, he had a political general. And we'll see, I mean, that could be in his favor. But as we'll see, it also did not always work out. Or perhaps he wasn't political enough. And we'll see how that works out. So shortly after Fort Donelson, Wallace is in charge of the 3rd Division in the lead-up to the Battle of Shiloh. Remember, everybody at this stage, Lew Wallace included, there's an amazing letter, I think, in the late 1851, where he's predicting a very short and deep war. Well, leading into the Battle of Shiloh, that's another stage of the Battle of Fort Donelson. Wallace is up here at Crump's Landing. Grant's down here at Pittsburgh Landing. Wallace was, his 3rd Division was being held in reserve, and he knew that sooner or later he was going to have to move up to reinforce Grant. By the way, much of what I will tell you about the Battle of Shiloh comes out of Gail Stevens' book. Again, she did a kind of blow-by-blow, move-by-move analysis of the controversy that ensued about Wallace's movement at Shiloh. One thing, there were at least two roads, an upper road called the Shunpike, by which he could come down and reinforce Grant, or then there was the lower or river road. Wallace actually took steps to improve the Shunpike so he could move his troops rapidly. But as Gil Stevens points out, there are a number of problems in the days leading up to the Battle of Shiloh, and that is Grant and Wallace were not communicating effectively with each other. Remember, a recipe for success. And then beyond that, both of them were unclear about the route by which Wallace was supposed to move up and reinforce that. So on the morning of April 6, 1862, a courier from Grant brings a written order to Wallace telling him to move up because General Beauregard was attacking Grant and actually caught Grant and General Sherman more or less flat-footed and unaware. So suddenly Wallace gets the order to move, and he's kind of assuming, his mindset has been, well, I'm going to move my division by the, what's called the Shunpike along this route here. And Grant doesn't understand why it's taking so long to get there, so he sent out another courier who intercepted Wallace about here. And the courier told him that Grant was originally intending to come by the river road. Well, in addition to contributing to the controversy as it developed then and later, is that the original written order from Grant was lost. Wallace handed it to an aide. The aide lost the written order. So Wallace never had the documentation back to decide the story. In any case, Wallace then countermarches back on the Shunpike and comes down this connecting road to reinforce Grant, gets there late in the day of the 6th of April, 1862. Battle of Shiloh continues for another 2 days. And in the immediate aftermath, Grant's after-action report was not critical, indeed it was somewhat complimentary of Wallace. In fact, on the second day, Wallace's division was ready to be in the forefront of the battle, and Grant had no immediate complaint. So it is that. Only problem was that the casualty level, as I'm sure you know, the Battle of Shiloh was the largest ever encountered on the North American continent in all of American history and all of the wars combined. So to go all the way back to the colonial period and stack up all the casualties, at Shiloh there were 23,000 plus casualties on both sides, 3,400 killed, and suddenly the public understood that this is not going to be a short war, it's going to be a long slog, and also suddenly General Grant had a public relations problem, and his aide started a whispering campaign that, you know, Wallace was late, Wallace was lost, Wallace didn't know what he was doing, it was all Wallace's fault, and so then that dogged Wallace really for the rest of the Civil War, and really into the post-war period, and it kind of haunted Wallace really for the rest of his life. Gail Stevens points out a number of interesting things, however, in some of the history accounts that you read, you know, that Wallace was relieved of command. Well, no, he was not relieved of command. He stayed on the job for at least a month. And actually, he was put in charge of commanding at Memphis. Basically, an occupying force in Memphis. And then was, at Wallace's own request, was given leave. And he went home to Crawford's for a while. It was not that he was relieved, was not back to command, from command, and he saw, however, that it was not good news either. That is, he was kind of put on a shelf, he was not being given interesting assignments, and he felt that this was, that he'd been, if you will, kind of sidelined. Actually, another of Gail Stevens' discoveries is that Wallace's problem, Wallace's bete noir, or if you will, enemy within the ranks of the army, was not Grant at all, it was Henry Halleck. And again, Henry Halleck resented a non-West Pointer who'd been promoted, he felt, sort of, he was Murphy's Law, somebody's been promoted beyond his level of competence. So Wallace is kind of on the shelf, his career is going anywhere. However, again, Wallace is sent into the breach by Governor Oliver Morton. Major problem, the Confederates under General Edmund Kirby Smith start threatening Cincinnati. And Morton, in communication, and he basically recommends Wallace to Secretary of War Edward Stanton. And so it's a federal appointment, and then the Army appoints Wallace to defend Cincinnati. Well, first stage, he arranges for earthworks, he organizes the city for defense, and then, like a good general, instead of just staying in defense, he takes the war to the enemy and crosses the Ohio River and sort of moves the defensive operations, transform the defensive operations into offensive operations against the Confederates on the Kentucky side. The defense of Cincinnati was so successful that the Confederates never directly attacked. He had a couple of other jobs, more or less interesting. Actually, he was put in charge of what was called parole camp in Columbus for a while, and then was put in his first appointment where my theory is he was actually put in some of these interesting jobs because of his training as a lawyer in civilian life. So he was put in charge of the what was called the Buell Commission. This was a commission of Army officers that was to, quote, investigate General Don Carlos Buell, who had been commanding in Kentucky and Tennessee, and was, if the War Department eventually reached the conclusion that Don Carlos Buell was prosecuting the war with insufficient energy, let's put it that way. he actually had not been present at the Battle of Perryville in Kentucky, and that was going on with him. And there are a number of other incidents that Union powers that he felt that Buell was simply not pursuing the war sufficiently aggressively. The commission met in Louisville, Cincinnati, and Nashville, ultimately presented an inconclusive report, but Buell's career was more or less over. Also, the reason I mentioned a little bit earlier that perhaps Wallace was sufficiently political, he could have at times a tin ear for the ramifications or consequences of what he was doing. So while he was kind of on the shelf, what did he do? He went to Washington and testified before the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War. Well, you can imagine what his fellow generals thought about that. You know, Wallace sort of going public as a politician, and that did not help his reputation at all. Also, by the time he gets to 1863, again, Morton summons Wallace once more in breach. Wallace is at home on leave in Crawfordsville. Suddenly, Brigadier General John Hunt Morgan attacks across the Ohio River, and Morton sends Wallace in pursuit of Morgan, runs Morgan out of the state and into Ohio, where ultimately Morton is apprehended. A friend of mine, while I was still, I should say, Morgan, John Hunt Morgan Grady, was a late in war. There was a serious threat to Indiana and finally, Wallace doctored most of the time of the war. He wasn't going very far very long. But suddenly, Abraham Lincoln did what I called deep selected wrong. And he intervened personally and put Wallace in charge of what had to be one of the most politically sensitive jobs I think the general could have. He was put in charge of the 8th Army Corps of the Mid-Department at Baltimore. Here's how I'm wondering Baltimore was a political, sensitive post. Maryland was one of the four key by a teaching American industry. I mentioned the 40-minute slave trade. They say, why, we thought that the Civil War was all about slavery. And I said, well, you know, this is where they get interesting. Yeah, they were for slavery, and keep Maryland on your side. They started the war, I think, with the Emancipation Proclamation. And ultimately, oh, and by the way, Wallace was granted the Emancipation Proclamation from the War Democrat. He said, well, however, any of us came into the Civil War, we're now all at war. That's the proclamation, and Flattery in this part of the country, he was rallying all over the Ohio when the emancipation January 1863. And then later in 1863, and early in put in charge of the situation in Maryland. By that stage, the 13th Amendment about slavery is in the process of ratification. And Lincoln and Secretary Stanton and the whole administration understood that if Maryland and the other Union slave states did not ratify the 13th Amendment until after the post parliament, if they were slow ratifying, if a majority was achieved to ratify before Maryland or any of the other slave states would ratify, then when you ratify later, it looked like they were merely conceding to the inevitable, right? So for not just public relations, but to the political reality, make it better. It is desirable that Maryland ratified, that Maryland voluntarily abolished slavery through state constitutional convention, a state constitutional amendment,
before the ratification of the 13th Amendment. Now, this is a challenge. Because, of course, there are, you know, a large slave owning population, a lot of people sympathizers. Step one, how long to crash down on the fence and halt me. Because I'm looking on this document that I just about fell out of the Carolina read a newspaper headline that says, General Wallace imprisons Francis Scott Key in Fort Donaldson. Paul McKenna, sorry. Yeah, Paul McKenna, okay. Yeah, you all understand and in order to understand this, I looked up, because this was in several generations after Francis Scott Key had written the Burnt Kind of Banner, when imprisoned in Fort McHenry, and he had a grandson of the same name, who was a Southern sympathizer in Baltimore, whom General Wallace locked up in Fort Kenneth. I turned that quote over to Dale Stevens. Step two, Wallace understood that the Confederates were going to be attacked on. And in this era, the strategic goal of Worcester was to capture the Union capital. So a lot of the Civil War strategy runs back and forth, you know, between Richmond and Washington. So at this stage, the Confederates are going to try to capture them. And there's an invasion group. Basically up through the Shenandoah Valley and reading in line, understanding that Wallace, you know, was under the cloud of Shiloh and concerned about the reputation, you can just sort of appreciate that he absolutely positively was not going to let anything like that happen again. So, in order to gain the maximum of reconnaissance and advance notice, first of all, we send a thing, electronic communication is, a new thing. Probably the electronic communication was 50 years ago, and the telegraph line ran along parallel with the railroad line, and Wallace made children to have a well-cultivated ally when the president of the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, John Wirt Garrett. So John Wirt Garrett gave Wallace a locomotive, and Wallace then drove the locomotive down the railroad line to gain advanced return of Jubal Early's movement. And so he found out early enough that Early was moving up the Shenandoah Valley, so Wallace made certain the relay station of the telegraph line was secure, so that his army in Baltimore had sufficient advance notice to get out there and do a blocking action against the Confederates. He sent notice to Grant, who at that stage was down in the peninsula, the northern neck of Virginia, and told him that General Early was on the way and they were attacking Washington and Grant had to move up. What Wallace did as monocracy is strategic delaying action. That is, you could say he lost the battle, but basically what he did was slow down Early so that by the time Grant, at this stage, Grant could come up with reinforced walls to get rid of him. And Grant immediately recognized that Wallace had pulled his check under the fire and had basically saved Washington and saved Grant. So monocracy, more or less, what we need Wallace's military reputation. Third thing, then, that Wallace did in the State Department in Baltimore to deal with this very delicate political challenge. How do you get Marylanders to abolish slavery before they're forced into it by the 13th Amendment? Before the 13th Amendment gained a majority ratification. Well,
Wallace, Mrs. Claire Wallace was sales and political general from the effect. He was very sensitive to civil-military relations. So he understood that he couldn't just walk in the President Haynes' office and talk about this. So he sent a telegram, and he would have a later agreement, he finally sent a telegram to traffic, as well as the President's staff, Secretary of War, and said, I must see the President, I'm leaving. And wanted to telegram the fact that that's fine. So Wallace wrote a White House and went on meetings with Lincoln to choreograph the state-level ramifications in Maryland to get state-level abolition of slavery before the First Amendment took effect. Towards the end of the war, you know, what good is a political general if you can't before him? Grant and Lincoln sent Wallace on a really sensitive reconnaissance diplomatic mission to Texas and Mexico in February and April of 1865 to negotiate the surrender of the Confederate Army under General Everett. His old opponent in the Cincinnati campaign, General Edmund Kirby Smith. After the assassination of President Lincoln, Wallace was once again put on one of the commissions that could make use of his legal training. So he was actually, Wallace was on the, as the Alexander Gardner portrait of Lincoln, here at the Indiana Historical Society, the society acquired the last plate negative of this portrait of Lincoln several years ago. Was Booth the assassin and some of his colleagues on Florida Cards graded at the time. And that's the military commission for the trial of the assassin. And that's Lew Wallace there. So he participated on that commission. That's the drawing of the courtroom and the preparation for the execution of the assassin. He also, another sensitive military appointment that could make use of his legal training was he was actually president of the military commission that tried the Andersonville war crimes trial of Henry Wirt, and Wirt was executed there. After the war, he resumed practice of law in Crawfordsville. He was not really keen on the day-to-day practice of law. He specialized in claims of Civil War veterans. He went on the lecture circuit. He started off giving lectures on the topic of Mexico and the Mexicans. He tried unsuccessfully to run for public office on a number of occasions. He did win elected office in the pre-war period as an Indiana State Senator, but I think I'm right in saying he never again won elected office. All his other offices were appointed. That was not for lack of trying. He ran for several congressional seats as well as the Senate, a couple of Senate races in the post-war period. Curiously, in 1870, he's running for Congress. He thinks the little town of Crawfordsville, you know, solidly Republican district, how can you lose as a distinguished general on the Republican ticket? Well, the little town of Crawfordsville had more than one Civil War general, and on the other side was the Democratic general, General Mellon Manson, and Manson beat Wallace in the 1870 congressional district election. Despite his delicate balancing act with Grant, but throughout the Republican Congress and post-war period, Wallace supports Grant, and despite the lingering dispute over where was Wallace at the time. Finally, in 1872, tree of a book that he'd been working on for 20 years. The Bear God. It was his first published novel that came out. And it was not a huge splash, but it was his first published novel. 3 years later, 1876, once more in the breach, a post that tapped into and took advantage of Wallace's legal training. 1876 was the great contested election between Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes, the proud Kenyon alumnus. And Wallace was sent down to court with a group known as the Visiting Statesmen to sort out and count the votes. Those of us who were working on the Wallace project in the year 2000 were absolutely astonished to discover, believe it or not, that from the same county in Florida that was in play in 2000 was also in play back in 1876. And that was right there in Leon County, Alabama, for Rutherford B. Hayes. And, you know, then this Visiting Statesman Commission declared, you know, Hayes the winner, and of course, he was one of our several minority votes that he won the minority of the popular vote, but won in the electoral college, thanks to the Washington Visiting Statesman. And, as a reward, President Hayes sent him to New Mexico as territorial governor. Very briefly, as a measure of what was going on in New Mexico, Wallace arrived by stagecoach, and when he left New Mexico, finally, at the end of his time as territorial governor, he traveled by a Pullman railroad car. Among other things that he had to deal with out there was Billy the Kid. He didn't get the full credit for rounding up Billy the Kid, but he entered into a negotiation with Billy the Kid and basically made him an offer, kind of a plea deal, if he would testify, if Billy the Kid would testify in another case. Ultimately, the prosecutor refused to honor the deal, and Billy the Kid escaped from prison and ultimately done that. But that's the kind of thing. This is all linked up with the dispute known as the Lincoln County War, the Grand War in New Mexico, while he was there. In New Mexico, in Santa Fe, Wallace completed his second night of entry in the governor's palace, the Trump palace, going back to the colonial period. In 1880, Harper and Brothers published Ben Hur, and one old President Garfield read it in his own press, that he decided to give Wallace the appointment as the United States Minister, what today we would call Ambassador, to Constantinople, not that alone. Among other things, he was facilitating arms purchases by the Ottoman Empire by, you guessed it, American arms manufacturers, not the least of which was Richard Gatling, when I had to check this out, I knew there was some connection between Wallace and Gatling, and essentially his brother-in-law, Wallace's brother-in-law, no, Gatling's brother-in-law, was new Wallace's stepfather, Joel Wallace. So they were, you know, interconnected, and also we found this is also true in the case of a number of Wallace's special missions to Mexico. Basically, he was running guns for Benito Juarez, who was during the Revolution of Mexico. Interestingly, for a non-West Pointer, he ends up on the Board of Trustees of West Point and an admiral in the post-war period. He also wrote another novel called The Prince of India, never quite as successful, and really nowhere near as successful as Ben Hur was. And back home in Crawfordsville, among other things, occupied himself with the construction of the building that we call the Blue Wall Study Facility. If you've been there, you know, it's a wonderful kind of Victorian relic
reflecting Wallace's tastes and his many travels. And if you've never been there, I highly recommend it. The most old red brick, healthy and expensive, in a city park in Fannyville that was under construction in 1896 that you can now date. He remained concerned about the issue of the Battle of Shiloh. Here he is around 1901 at the Shiloh was converted to the National Military Park, and on the right side of this photo is Cornelius Cable, who was the chairman of the Shiloh National Military Park Commission. And essentially, Wallace was in the microphone and continuing to push his side of the story of Shiloh. And you want to make sure the right side of the story got out, and he's very much concerned about Battle of monuments and inscriptions thereon, and he went on revising the Battle of Shiloh for the rest of his life. Ultimately, during his own lifetime, Ben-Hur was produced as a Broadway stage play that then went on the road, so this is a play called of the stage production of Ben-Hur. Then finally, Lew Wallace dies in 1905. And Susan Wallace worked on bringing out his autobiography, which was published in two volumes in 1906. Very well written autobiography. Actually, significantly, not the writing one, takes the story up to the Battle of Shiloh and no further. And then Susan Wallace had to basically finish the book. Mainly with excerpts of documents, but it's still a great read. In 1910, the state of Indiana had the opportunity to choose two of its favorite sons to represent the state in Statuary Hall of the Rotunda of the Capitol of Washington. And this is the statue of Lew Wallace, which represents our state. It was carved by Andrew O'Connor, and perhaps it's not surprising that the other statue, the second figure that represents our state in the Capitol building, is that of Governor Oliver Morton. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about both Lew Wallace and Susan Wallace and the edition, forthcoming of their paper, and I'll be happy to.
Flat-footed
by the Confederates, so basically, there's a lot of blame spread around, but so far as, well, telling the truth as he saw it, as he understood it, in the field, at the time, on the line, I'm confident that he believed what he said. That would have been approximately 1880. I think he leaves. The one thing, Ben-Hur is published in 1880, and then he leaves the next year to go to Turkey. Actually, the date of his meeting with Billy the Kid is the 17th of March, 1879.
Is there certain through his papers and things like that, did you find any indication of Lew Wallace as a songwriter?
Oh, I wish I could remember. There are. I can't remember who wrote those guys then.
I've not one.
Let me see it, and I'll tell you if it looks familiar. But I know there's sheet music in the edition. I just can't remember who was the, if I can call him this, the librettist. I mean, I couldn't even. Well, actually, he had musical interest. He played violin, and he commissioned Late in Life out of Violin Mason. So, let me walk over there, and I'll take a quick look at that, and I'll tell you about it.
Okay, this one is called The School of Stars.
Yep, we got that in the edition.
Okay,
you have it. It's in the edition, yeah.
Okay.
That doesn't say on the cover. Did he write the words?
All right. The top line says, Stolen Stars or Good Old Father Washington, written by General L. Wallace, music adapted and arranged by someone by the name of Hastings. At the bottom, the words of this song are from Parker's Weekly and are used by Frank Provision and Parker and Brothers.
They were his publishers, so
yeah.
So they may have owned the copyright.
So what he did? The story apparently is at a dinner at which were present Major General Lewis Wallace, Lieutenant Reed, and James Murdoch. A conversation sprung up respecting ballads for soldiers. The general maintains that hardly one had been written suited for the camp. It was agreed that each of them should write one. And this is the one written by General Wallace. They apparently didn't know of some of the other good songs that came out of the Army camp, especially the most famous one, the Army Dean, but that's another story.
Is there a date on that?
Yes. 1863. Published in Ohio.
Okay, I think that Charles Buchanan Reed was on Wallace's staff as early as Cincinnati. And let's see, Cincinnati, I think, was late 1862. Cincinnati. And then I think Reed stayed with him. Let's see. Yeah, the Defense of Cincinnati is August to September 1862, and I think Reed stays with him on his staff and may have been with him in Baltimore. And Reed, well, the Thomas Buchanan Reed was a poet among his brothers as well.
I was going to ask if you had touched on the situation regarding William Bonner, but you did.
Yeah, as best I can, yeah.
And Billy the Kid was really teased off.
Oh, yeah.
The promises were that major were not kept.
Yeah, well, I guess my take on that is if you're Lew Wallace from the territorial governor of New Mexico and you have an opportunity to bring in Billy the Kid, you'll tell him anything. You can go tell him anything, you get him to come in. And then my recollection is that it was that Wallace did order the prosecutor to release him, and the prosecutor refused to do so. And then the kid broke out of.
Jail.
He broke out of jail and then he was later.
He got the jailer's gun and shot.
Yeah.
But he was done. He had an in for Lew Wallace.
Well, actually, Billy the Kid had an in for a lot of people. And by the way, that whole field, the
the Lincoln County Wars and Billy the Kid, the whole field of a real potter industry. It's like, you know, the detail of the Battle of Shiloh. You've got to have a taste for detail in order to wade into that.
One more. Okay. So if you do have one, come down afterwards and talk to Tom.